This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In last night's address to the nation, President Bush called Iraq's Abu Ghraib prison a symbol of disgraceful conduct by a few American troops who dishonored our country and disregarded our values. Stories of abuse and humiliation coming from Iraq prompted critics of the American prison system to charge that brutal treatment is also common in jails and penitentiaries here at home. They say U.S. prisons suffer from some of the same conditions that contributed to the abuse at Abu Ghraib: overcrowding, increasingly tight budgets, and inadequate training for guards. Other corrections professionals disagree. A recent statement released by the American Correctional Association said that while abuses may occur on occasion in U.S. prisons and jails, these incidents are certainly not widespread and are quickly and appropriately addressed. Later in the program, call and email us with your experiences with the eruption of cicadas across much of the country and your past experiences with Brood X. But first, U.S. prison conditions. If you're a former inmate or a corrections officer, join us. Is abuse in the American prison system isolated, or is this Abu Ghraib without pictures? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us here in Studio 3A is Jeffrey Ian Ross, the author of Behind Bars, Surviving Prison. He worked for over 3 years at a correctional facility. He's currently a criminologist at the University of Baltimore. Nice of you to be with us today.
Pleasure to be here.
And also with us is Martin Horn. He's commissioner of the Department of Corrections for the City of New York and former Secretary of Corrections for the State of Pennsylvania. He's with us by phone from his office on Rikers Island in New York City. And thanks for taking the time to speak with us today.
You're quite welcome, Neil.
Jeff Ross, let's start with you. You've studied American prisons for many years. Did the abuses we've heard from Abu Ghraib sound like anything you've seen here in the U.S.?
They are quite an anomaly, but I'd hate to completely make a one-to-one comparison between the two conditions. I think here you have, at least in Baghdad, the individuals who were supervising their charges weren't trained like American correctional officers are. They were also in a war situation, and it was a very difficult situation for them to begin with. I'm not making any apologies for the soldiers who've been charged with or who have been convicted of abuse, but things are quite different here in the United States than they are overseas.
And Martin Horn, another big difference is obviously at Abu Ghraib, there was interrogations underway. People were seeking information from these prisoners.
Well, that's exactly right. And I don't think that there is a self-respecting prison administrator in this country who would allow the police to come into his or her jail to talk to them or instruct them in how to treat their inmates or to conduct interrogations there. You know, one of the things that we depend on in running jails is legitimacy. We run prisons and jails because the inmates allow us to, because the inmates trust that we have their best interests at heart. And when we behave in ways that cost us that trust, we lose control of our prisons. So to engage in those kinds of behaviors would be very self-defeating for prison administrators.
In that, are you referring to, there are uncomfortable situations in the state of New York, going back to Attica, and certainly riots at the Tombs there in the New York City prison system, not all that long ago. Was that those circumstances under which?
It was long ago. I mean, that was 30 years ago. It was more than 30 years ago since Attica, and I think we've come a long way since then. I think that.
But are those circumstances under which you thought that legitimacy you were talking about was lost?
Exactly. That's what happens when you lose legitimacy. I think there's another very big difference that's ignored. Prisons and jails in this country are far more transparent than these military lockups. Our inmates have almost daily access to their attorneys. Inmates in most state prisons and county jails all over this country have daily access to telephones. They have absolutely free access to writing letters. They can make collect phone calls to the press. They receive visits from family and from lawyers. And so there is no way that any kind of a systematic practice like this would go unreported.
Jeff, I wonder if you agree that there are systematic abuses just don't occur in this country.
Systematic abuses? I think there's systematic abuses. I think there's periodic abuses, too. And I think what the former commissioner has suggested is in a best case scenario. In many prisons, we know that because of the pressures of the work environment, because of understaffing, that not all prisoners, convicts, get a chance to use the phone when they can use the phone, and it's not always every day, and not every day can they see their lawyer, and their lawyers have to run a gauntlet of inspections, and not every lawyer wants to visit with their client every day, for that matter. I think that both physical and psychological abuse happens on a daily basis. When it gets out of control, certainly there are checks and balances both inside prisons and in state departments of corrections that can keep it in check. But a lot of this goes on, behind closed doors. We also, correctional officers, skilled correctional officers and administrators have to run an efficient organization through policies and procedures. And those are ways of shaping convict conduct and ways of also, managing to police and sanction them, too.
Well, if I may, Jeff, because you did earlier say that you thought this behavior was an anomaly, how do you deal with the whole issue of legitimacy? If, in fact, it were going on systematically, don't you agree that officers and prison administrators would be robbed of their legitimacy and the inmates would let us know that?
No question about it. If something like this happened in a U.S. prison, that is these worst cases of torture and abuse. I think what I'm referring to, and I know you've experienced this, if not heard stories about it, either in your jail or in the state of Pennsylvania, where prisoners who are perceived to be management problems, they're given countless numbers of reports, incident reports, or shots, as they're called, they're sent to the hole on a regular basis. They're searched on a regular basis as many times as they want, as many times as the correctional officers deem is necessary. These are all governed by the rules and regulations that the correctional facility has, and the correctional officers are simply using those as tools to get compliance by the convicts or by other prisoners so that they get with the program. Or if they dislike the convict, they can search their cell as many times as they want. They can toss their cells under the pretense of looking for contraband as many times as they want.
Well, but first of all, I would submit that is vastly different than what we've seen. I mean, any self-respecting corrections official is aghast at what they've seen out of Abu Ghraib. And secondly, inmates have the ability to write home. If they're being hassled, they have the ability to file grievances. And while I'm not disputing that individual officers can find ways to hassle inmates, it's the challenge of management and one that management takes on to place controls, to instill values in their staff, to train their staff, and to have proper supervision. You know, one of the big differences between American prisons, at least the ones that I'm familiar with, and Abu Ghraib, is the presence of management staff on the night shift. One of the things that we saw was very low-level, untrained soldiers running cell blocks absent any supervisory oversight. That's something that would rarely happen in an American prison.
No, I agree with you. And also that the American prisons are subject to investigations by third parties, ombudsman. Also, if a jail or a prison system, it wants to be accredited by the American Correctional Association, they must pass certain rules, regulations, thresholds. Also, each state has their own training academy or training process, and correctional officers have a probationary period. And there's ways of dismissing, warning, retraining, giving in services to beef up the skills of and practices, policies, all that sort of thing of correctional officers.
Yeah. Let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. The number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And first caller is Robin, who's with us from Norman, Oklahoma.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Obviously, I don't see everything. I can't visit at all times. But one of the biggest things that I know about is inmate-on-inmate violence. In the state of Oklahoma, our laws were changed to increase criminal penalties for many things. At the same time, our budgets simply crashed. We don't have enough officers to assure that everyone is covered and everyone is safe, nor do we have enough program availability to help people change their behavior. It's scary for everyone involved.
And what do you do at the prisons, Robin?
I am a correctional case manager. It kind of equates with social work.
Okay. And so the biggest problem you're seeing as a result of all of this?
The biggest problem is that inmates don't feel safe, staff doesn't feel safe, and when you put that sort of stress on a system, eventually something somewhere is going to blow up. We do very well with what we have because we have lots of officers working overtime, some of which, you know, they don't ever see the time off that goes with it. We have people working double shifts. All the staff gives 100% because we have to assure that we're all safe. But the system will break sometime. There's just nothing to be done about it. We just need more officers, more programs, more money. Either that or fewer people in prison. Actually, that would be the better solution, but that involves politicians having the courage to change the laws.
Robin's calling from Norman, Oklahoma, but I don't think her situation is unique, Jeff Ross.
Not at all. I don't think so. And particularly in the post-9/11 era, when we've overspent state budgets, particularly our public safety budgets, that part of the public safety budget that's earmarked to corrections and to probation and parole has suffered the most. And so what prisons and jails are now doing or are forced to do is, you know, do more with less, and usually that means less staff. And, we have a considerable number of people who are retiring as jail guards and as correctional officers. You have a infrastructure which is deteriorating on a daily basis. And so jails and prisons and have three objectives. And number one is community safety. Number two is rehabilitation, and next is punishment. And what, you know, jails and prisons are disproportionately doing when there's lack of money is just focusing on either community safety or just simply punishment.
Commissioner Horn, I know that overcrowding has been cited as a problem in every prison disturbance that I can remember.
Well, certainly overcrowding complicates the matter, and there's no question but that in the United States we do over-rely on imprisonment as a response to crime, and I think we have not been as creative or as aggressive as we could be or should be with respect to the way in which we deal with crime, and it certainly makes the challenges that prison administrators face all the more difficult, but not insuperable. Certainly it's a contributing factor.
Robin, is there any break in sight for you? I think Robin has already left us. We thank her for her call. Would you say that Rikers Island is overcrowded at this point, Commissioner Horn?
Well, as a matter of fact, Neil, interestingly, the population at Rikers Island in New York City has decreased by some 7,000 inmates since the early 90s. Today, we're holding fewer than 14,000 inmates. At one time, we were holding 22,000. All of our inmates are in single cells or are in dormitories with ample space. In accordance with nationally recognized standards. In fact, I would say that our standards exceed national standards. This Friday, we're graduating a class of 400 new correction officers. So I would not say that we're overcrowded. In fact, I have four jails that are shuttered and mothballed.
Martin Horn is Commissioner of the Department of Corrections in the City of New York. We're also speaking with Jeff Ross, the author of Behind Bars, Surviving Prison. When we come back from a short break, we'll take more of your calls. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing the state of American prisons today, particularly the subject of abuse. Do you think abuse in U.S. prisons is isolated, or is it something that's just not reported as often as it happens? You're invited to join us. Our number is 800-989-8255. The email address is TOTN@NPR.org. We're speaking with Martin Horn, Commissioner of the Department of Corrections in New York City, former Secretary of Corrections for the state of Pennsylvania, and with Jeffrey Ian Ross, who's worked for more than 3 years at a correctional facility, now a criminologist at the University of Baltimore. Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Steve, who's with us from Indianapolis.
Hi, Neil.
Hi.
First thing that I thought of when I saw the Iraq abuse pictures come out was, I'll bet you that most of those soldiers have correctional experience.
I think, as it turns out, two of them do.
Yes, and other ones come from areas that have correctional industries, such as Cumberland, Maryland. And but I did 16 years altogether in four different prison systems, Florida, Illinois, Kentucky, and the feds. And I'll say this, they need video cameras in there, because the abuse is in every one of those systems and in every other system I've ever heard of.
Commissioner Horn, I think there are video cameras in many places, at least, in Rikers Island.
As a matter of fact, there are. We, in our intake areas, in fact, we have a policy that every time we anticipate using force against an inmate, we record it on video. And I'd like to point out, interestingly, I was reading one of the professional journals today, and it reports a case out of Illinois in February in which the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals actually threw out a complaint by an inmate of improper physical force against the inmate. It was an Eighth Amendment violation claim, and they based it upon a videotape, which the court showed that the strip search was conducted in, and I quote the court's words here, in a discreet and expeditious manner. So videotaping is a very effective tool, and we use it quite widely.
Steve, when you were in prison, did you feel as if you could report instances of abuse, that people would take that seriously?
If you reported some type of abuse, you could expect to have more abuse. You could also expect to be transferred to another prison. You would be flagged. They would know about it wherever you went. And there are ways to get back at inmates. The video cameras don't follow you everywhere, and the states are the worst about it, especially the state of Florida. They'll put you in situations with other inmates that they know that you will have a conflict with them. And then it's inmate-on-inmate violence. They're so-called not responsible. You can't file an Eighth Amendment claim against another inmate, you know.
Jeff, I wanted to ask you, as a former corrections officer, I mean, are guards encouraged to come forward if they witness an abuse, or are they regarded by their fellows as snitches?
Well, correctional officers are encouraged to come forward, and they're trained to do that, or taught that in the police academy, but the correctional training academy. But like police, they suffer from or operate in a system where there is that blue wall of silence. There's a strong socializing effect of their peer group, and they realize that they depend upon them on a daily basis for proper information, for coverage. Watching their back. And so when they do witness abuse, there's a strong proclivity not to report it to higher-ups, to senior officers. I might add, too, that I don't think that video cameras are the be-all and the end-all. I think they're a step in the right direction. You know, video cameras, as we know, can be tampered with. Video evidence is not, you know, inadmissible, is not what closes a case on violence by correctional officers, police officers, or any other state official. But I think, among other things, there needs to be regular inspections of our correctional facilities by outside parties, not by members of the Department of Corrections, and not necessarily some accrediting team from the American Correctional Association.
Exactly.
I think those sorts of regular inspections and by the media for that matter, would go a long way in minimizing prisoner abuse and complaints against prison authorities.
Is that some of the transparency you were talking about earlier, Commissioner Horn?
Very much so. In New York State, there's an independent body called the State Commission on Correction that actually is created by the state constitution, which has it's an independent board, and it has the obligation to inspect every prison and jail in the state, has the authority to close them down or to take other actions.
Steve, thanks very much for the call.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it. Here's an email we got from John Londigan. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, in Dublin, California. I'm a correctional worker in a federal prison, a teacher. I can tell you that if anything remotely approaching the activities of Abu Ghraib were to happen in my facility, there would be a major house cleaning from top to bottom, warden to correctional officer. One problem is public relations. On the one hand, there seems to be a large segment of the population that sees prisons as bastions of violence where inmates are constantly abused. On the other hand, there are those who believe that inmates really have no rights and that they are should be abused, and that's what they were convicted for. I think prisons need to do a better job of educating the public on the fact that the vast majority of U.S. facilities are really in between those two views. Jeff Ross, is that something that resonates with you?
I think that's an excellent interpretation of what's going on. I think the general public, majority of the public, believes that those who are behind bars are there for a good reason, and that when we hear instances of people who are wrongly convicted of a crime, that's just an anomaly, nothing that we would expect from a prison system. Also, I'm not sure that better public relations is the key for correctional facilities. I think the buzz or the talk about public relations in corrections is more of advertising these days, educating the public, lobbying, and those are the kinds of public relations that I don't think is going to benefit the American public. What they really want to do, I think what the American public needs to do, is be better informed about prisons. A lot of that is dependent upon the media. Most large news organizations do not have a dedicated crime reporter or police reporter who also covers the jails or the prisons. Only when we hear about worst-case scenarios like a prison break, an escape attempt from a prison, or prisoner abuse, prison violence, or a new class of recruits or a new warden coming in to a prison, do we hear news about a prison. For the most part, prisoners are out of sight, out of mind, and the American public likes it that way.
Let's get another caller on the line. Rick is with us from Sacramento.
Hi, Neil.
Okay, hi, how are you?
Good, thank you. I wanted to make a sort of a comment and kind of a question as well. I wanted to ask, I'm not sure who made this statement earlier, if it was Martin or Jeffrey, but I hear a lot of talk about lack of training. They weren't trained right, speaking about the soldiers at Abu Ghraib and or correctional officers here in the States. And I want to say, why should someone need to be trained when it comes to treating people with dignity, with not stripping them down naked and putting them on a dog leash? I mean, do we really need to train people to not do that? I mean, isn't that basic human values and dignity? I mean, or is it that when we're put in these situations of authority, this is the way we act as people? And if so, we need to examine that, I think.
Commissioner Horn, you seem best placed to answer that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a reasonable question. First of all, I think what we learned from the Zimbardo study is that, unfortunately, the default culture when people are placed in the position of captive and captor is that the worst of human behavior sometimes emerges. And so training is in part to instill a sense of values. I think the corrections organizations work best when they're value-based organizations. Secondly, I think it's also to help the individuals who are placed in these positions of authority with individuals who are capable of, so to speak, pushing their buttons. We have to teach them how to avoid allowing their buttons to be pushed and giving them tools to respond so that they feel safe so that they can respond in an appropriate way. And if I may, I'd like to just add to the comment that came a moment earlier about public relations, is to observe that I think that much of what the public believes to be true about American prisons is what I refer to as the Oz effect. That awful television program, I think, has terribly maligned the professionalism of people who work in corrections and created a very, very unfortunate and inaccurate picture in the American mind and perhaps in the world's mind about what life in America's prisons is like, because I've yet in 35 years in this business to see a prison or jail that operated like that.
Rick, thanks for the call. And I'd like to thank both of our guests. Martin Horn, we just heard, the Commissioner of the Department of Corrections for New York City, the former Secretary of Corrections for the state of Pennsylvania. He took time out of his busy day to speak with us by the phone from his office in Rikers Island in New York City. Thanks very much, Commissioner.
You're welcome.
Jeffrey Ian Ross, the author of Behind Bars, Surviving Prison. He worked for over 3 years at a correctional facility, currently a criminologist at the University of Baltimore. Thanks for driving down to visit with us here in Studio 3A.
My pleasure.
If you are joining us now to talk about what it's like to work inside a maximum security prison is Ted Conover. He spent a year working as an undercover guard at Sing Sing Prison in New York. He then wrote a book about his experiences called New Jack, Guarding Sing Sing, and he's with us from our bureau in New York. Good of you to join us today.
Thank you, Neil.
We've been talking about how common it is or is not for abuses to occur inside U.S. prisons. What sort of things did you witness or experience?
Well, all kinds of different things, and I guess I kind of see it from both sides because I wasn't a career corrections person, and yet after working that job for a few months, I felt a lot of sympathy for them.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me.
Sure.
One of my first encounters with the strange way things operate in prison was a day when my lockup inmates, people who'd broken rules and were confined to their cells, were being let out for a special recreation period, and a guard I'd never met came around the corner and said, A32 cell, don't let him out. And I said, okay, what's up? And he didn't say anything, and he just left. So I was a rookie, and I thought if a senior officer tells me what to do, even if it's not, even if it's against procedure, I'm going to go along with him. But to cover myself, I made a note in the log that I didn't let that prisoner out because of officer thus and such.
Smith, whatever. Yeah.
Smith. And the inmate flew into a rage. He destroyed his cell. He threw things out through the bars. He poured water. He tried to hit me with objects. He filed a grievance using the prison's grievance system in which he alleged that I had deprived him of his right to exercise. And in fact, I had, and I had done it wrongly. It turned out that he, according to this other officer, he had punched a corrections officer earlier, and this was part of his payback, which was an informal sort of incarceration when it shouldn't have been happening. You know, inmates have to get out for their exercise. But this went up through the levels, and the captain came and talked to me one day and said, what's all this about, Conover? And I told him the story, and he said, this is nothing we can't manage. And I said, the problem, Captain, is that I logged it. And he looked at me like, you did what? Are you insane? And this required some extra levels of finessing. And what ended up happening was a retroactive deprivation order materialized for this inmate, which, in other words,
legitimized an illegitimate order.
Correct. And so the system covered itself, and I was covered, so I was, I suppose, grateful. The officer who had told me to do this was covered, but every day after that, when I saw this guy, he stared me down, and it's because I logged it. It's because I...
This guy, you mean Officer Smith, we're calling.
Correct. That's the one I was worried about. I wasn't worried about repercussions from an angry inmate. I was worried about the anger of my fellow officer, because lots of days I'd be alone with maybe 80 inmates. Often when they're coming in or going out, they're all out of their cells at once. They're a lot bigger and tougher than me. And if something happens, I'm going to need help from somebody like Officer Smith. And I'm exactly the guy Officer Smith might now be slow to respond to a cry for help from, because I didn't go along with the program. So that kind of thing, you know, I admire Commissioner Martin Horn a lot. He's an enlightened administrator. But every prison has ways of covering up bad things that go on. Even the best run, I've got to believe, have ways of people looking out for their own.
Ted Conover is the author of New Jack, Guarding Sing Sing. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another listener in on the conversation. Rodney joins us from Milwaukee.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air, Rodney.
Oh, yeah. Great program, and thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Let's see. I had a couple comments, but let me make the first one. And this was in relation to what your guests have been talking about, but kind of a parallel to what's going on in Iraq. First off, whenever you put somebody in a position where they have power over people, and they're of different cultures, and I'm not speaking of color, I'm talking about their culture, there's always potential for abuse. And I think that one of the things that concerns me is, first of all, that people are so concerned that this happened, as if it hadn't happened. And the other part is that now everybody is getting on the bandwagon of, oh, we're doing rehabilitation, and we're this and that, and we're that. When the truth of the matter is quite opposite, we probably spin ourselves into a hole in the prison systems in the United States, as well as we spin ourselves into the war overseas. And I think the other thing is that when cultures collide and people are given that inclination to think about, oh, what they did to us, there's a lot of abuse going on. And I know guards have to work that out inside, but a lot of guards, and this is statistics, some guards have a high propensity toward abuse outside of the prison. So I guess to the caller or to the guest, I'd want to know, how do they view that, and what are they doing about that?
Yeah, how do you separate your work from home? Ted Conover?
You know, it's interesting. I got involved in this because I thought the prison officer's perspective was sort of missing from the prison debate, and that these guys know inmates in a certain way more intimately than anybody else, and I wanted to write about them. I applied to follow a recruit through the training academy for the New York State Department of Correctional Services up in Albany because I thought, here's the perfect lab to answer that the caller's question. Are the people who arrive here people with a predisposition toward violence or abuse, or are they normal people and something happens to them as they travel through the system? And the answer is not black or white. I think there's a self-selection in terms of for prison officers. A lot of people choose for it based on their size. Larger than average people are attracted because they're going to have an easier time. People who've been in the military often head for corrections. But I don't think these are people who are worse than the ordinary citizen. I do think that after time on the job, you develop a lot of frustration and anger, which is often directed toward inmates. These are often people who will torment you, or, you know, push the buttons that the commissioner was talking about, try to make your life miserable. If you're professional, the job is all about forbearance. You don't act on those impulses to murder those guys or beat them up. You don't respond to profanity with profanity. You stay calm, you stay measured and even, but inside you get worked up, and it's hard not to act on that sometimes.
Ted Conover, thanks very much.
Thank you, Neil.
Ted Conover's book is New Jack, Guarding Sing Sing, details the year he spent as a guard at Sing Sing Maximum Security Prison in New York State. He joined us from our bureau in New York. When we come back from a short break, everyone is buzzing about the red-eyed flying creatures that have taken over much of the country. The invasion of Brood X. Next, call us with your experiences with the cicadas. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.